If you've been diagnosed with a brain tumor, it's normal to feel overwhelmed. But understanding your diagnosis as well as treatment options can help you make the best decision towards your health and recovery. We're going to talk about it today with Dr. Nicholas Mitras, a neuro-oncologist with the Gerald J. Glasser Brain Tumor Center. This is Building Healthier Communities, the podcast from Atlantic Medical Group. I'm Prakash Chandran. So first of all, Dr. Mitras, can you tell us about the different types of brain tumors?
Sure. There are a number of different kinds of brain tumors, and they all kind of relate to what structures they originate from in the brain. I think when we talk about some of the most common brain tumors, one of which would be a meningioma originating from the meninges, which is the lining surrounding the brain. But when we talk about things that actually occur within the meat of the brain itself, so to speak, usually that falls under the umbrella of a glioma. And then that can come into different families like an astrocytoma or an oligodendroglioma. And one of the big differences in brain tumors, as opposed to tumors elsewhere in the body, with breast cancers and lung cancers, we talk about stages. And with brain tumors, we talk a lot about grades. And so the higher the grade, the more aggressive the tumor may be.
Can you talk to us about that grade scale? Like, what's the bottom and what's the high end of it?
Sure, absolutely. Let's use astrocytomas as an example. With astrocytomas, they run from grades 1 through 4. 1 is usually just seen in the pediatric population, and 2, 3, and 4 are what I normally encounter when I see my adult patients, with 4 being the one that has been in the news quite a bit with recent famous diagnoses, and that would be glioblastoma, grade 4 astrocytoma. The grade implies how aggressive the tumor may be, and also is how we meet that tumor's aggressiveness with our aggressive treatment. So with a grade 1, usually those don't spread too much into the brain and don't tend to come back. And you can actually have a surgery. If you take all of it out, that can be curative. Whereas with grades 2, 3, and 4, we usually need to follow that up with additional treatment after surgery.
And, you know, I'm curious as to if people experience symptoms associated with brain tumors. Like, how do they know when they might have one?
Sure. With brain tumors and really anything in the brain, it's not about what you have, but where you have it in the brain that's going to tell you the symptoms that you have. Sure, there are some generic symptoms like a headache, but not your typical headache. These tend to be headaches that arise in people that aren't typical headache patients, or usually headaches that begin early in the day and are very intense, but then kind of taper off as the day goes on. And when I say about where in the brain, we know that the right side of the brain controls the left side of the body for our sensory and motor. And so a tumor on the right side of the brain might result in something like left-sided weakness or numbness, whereas a tumor on the left side would result in weakness or numbness on the right side. Seizures could also be a possibility as a presenting symptom. And again, the kind of seizure that you have really depends on where in the brain that tumor may lie.
And what do we know about why brain tumors occur? Is it just completely random? Are there certain factors that are associated with it?
Sure. So this has been an interest of mine because it's a question that's commonly asked. And so I like to do talks at our brain tumor support group. And one of the talks that I did a deep dive into the potential causes for brain tumors, just trying to dispel some rumors that are out there and also validate some of the ideas of where brain tumors come from that we actually have some evidence behind. And what I found was that there's only 2 real causes that we know of for brain tumors. One of those would be a brain tumor that is associated with a genetic condition, so something that's inherited from your family. And usually patients who have a brain tumor associated with this cause, there's a long line of cancer in their family. So, and I'm not just talking about a great uncle that may have had lung cancer and a cousin who had colon cancer. I'm talking about a long line of many family members who have been diagnosed with cancers. The second one that we know of is radiation. And I'm not just talking about the exposure of radiation when you're getting treatment, because that radiation is more targeted and focused at your tumor. This would be more the radiation that was associated with like the atom bombs in Hiroshima. We know that those that were near the epicenter of where those bombs hit, there was a greater amount of patients who developed brain tumors after that because of the exposure to that great amount of uncontrolled radiation. For the most part, though, patients who are diagnosed with brain tumors, it is a random mutation that was not corrected in the DNA that then allowed that cell to continue to multiply uncontrolled. And our understanding is that that would be the main source of the start of a brain tumor.
And just to expand on that a little bit, you know, I have to ask the question, what about our cell phones? You know, so many of us have probably heard in the news or the media that using your cell phone without a headset too close to the head can potentially cause a brain tumor. Is there any truth in that?
So that was another one of the things that I really took a deep dive into because I wanted to know where that originated from. And based on what I looked at, there is an episode of Larry King Live in the early 90s where a gentleman had gone on and was talking about a lawsuit that he was involved in for the wrongful death of his wife. And he was suing a cell phone company and a carrier. And it was really after that episode aired that people really started talking about the concern about cell phone radiation and brain tumors. And in the end, in that specific case, the judge actually dropped the lawsuit because there was no good evidence to support his claims. So the government actually went back and did a 10-year, $30 million study where they took a look at rats and mice, and it was over 1,000 rats and mice that they looked at, and they exposed them to radiation for 9 hours a day. That was about the equivalent of a 2G or a 3G cell phone. So now we're getting into the 4 and even 5G cell phones. And the newer models, they have less radiation that they're giving off. So this is based on older models that were giving off more radiation. And what they found was that there was no clear evidence that the radiation that was being given to these rats was causing any kind of brain tumors. And, you know, we can't make a direct correlation because people aren't rats, and these rats were receiving whole body radiation. It wasn't just targeted toward their head. And so now as we move into the 4G and 5G cell phones, their radiation is safer.
You know, I have to tell you that this is a relief to hear, and it should settle some debates that I have with my friends. So thank you very much for that.
No problem.
So let's move on to diagnosis and treatment options. First of all, tell us how brain tumors are diagnosed in the first place.
So now we're in the age where there's a lot of imaging that's done that probably wouldn't have gotten done in the past. So sometimes we find brain tumors where there were no symptoms at all. Someone came in for an MRI of the brain or a CT scan of the head, and they were looking for something else. And incidentally, we find that there's a change on the brain that then needs to be either monitored or needs to be addressed by a neurosurgeon. In other cases, people know that they've had these new developments of headaches or weakness on one side or seizures, and they either go to their general doctor with these concerns, or they go to a neurologist, or if it's a seizure, they may present into the ER. All of these eventually lead to imaging of the head, whether that be initially a CT scan or an MRI. We find that there's something there that's abnormal, and usually the first stop after that will be the neurosurgeon.
I see. And does the neurosurgeon then assess and then provide treatment options? And if so, talk about some of the different medical and surgical options that are available.
Sure. So based on a tumor's appearance, let's say, for an example, the meningioma that I talked about before, in some of those cases, we can just monitor that meningioma given its size, its location, and whether or not that patient is symptomatic. We may not even have to go in for surgery. In other cases, it may be the case that going into the brain too far may affect other very important structures, so that taking all of a tumor out may not be an option. And in that case, we may do a subtotal resection. And when I say we, I mean the neurosurgeon, or just a biopsy to at least get a piece of it so that we know what it is. The goal would be in other tumors that appear to be more of the higher grade gliomas, more common things that we encounter, we would want to get as much of it out as possible. And then having that tissue would give us a better idea of what the tumor is, and then that helps to guide the treatment.
You know, there's probably people listening to this that may have recently been diagnosed with a brain tumor. I'm curious as to if there are any patient success stories that you might be able to share with them and with us.
Absolutely. We know a lot more about brain tumors now than we did in the last decade or two decades. Namely, that what we put under the microscope after a surgery is not the end-all be-all of a tumor. Sure, we can take a look at the tissue, and the tissue will be representative of maybe the grade of the tumor that it is and give us a name to it. But now we understand that there's more to it than that at the DNA level. And so the second report that we usually get on a tumor will be if that tumor has any kind of mutations. And I think that being raised on, you know, television and movies, that we're taught to think that mutations are a bad thing, when really, from the neuro-oncologist standpoint, a mutation may actually be something of benefit because we can use it as a potential target for treatment. Or additionally, some mutations actually tell us about how that tumor will behave. And in some cases, it may tell us about how the tumor may respond to different kinds of treatment. So I think that our understanding of one glioblastoma versus another glioblastoma in present day is a lot better because we can use the mutations to tell us, you know, this patient will probably do better than this patient. And I think that when you put together that new knowledge, we've seen some patients who have outlasted what we expect their prognosis to be by months or even years.
Yeah, that's fantastic and a perfect place to end. So really, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Mitras. I truly appreciate it. That's Dr. Nicholas Mitras, a neuro-oncologist with the Gerald J. Glasser Brain Tumor Center. Thanks for checking out this episode of Building Healthier Communities. For a consultation, please call the Gerald J. Glasser Brain Tumor Center, part of the Atlantic Medical Group, based in Summit, New Jersey, at 908-522-5941. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it on your social channels and be sure to check out the entire podcast library for topics of interest to you. Thanks, and we'll talk next time.